Hello, good day to you wherever you are. My name is Edmond Sena Anulochu, and this is Public International Law on Laudio. Straight to business, let's talk about sources of international law. We have spoken about international conventions or treaties. Now let's move straight to customary international law as a source of public international law as opined in Article 38.1 of the Statute of the ICJ. Now, the existence of customary rules can be deduced from the practice and behavior of states generally accepted as laws. So the continual practice of a certain behavior or certain norm will make that norm customary international law. Now, customary international law can be ascertained from two basic principles: the material facts, which are the state practices, and then opinio juris, which is subjective belief of states, as was held in the Libya and Malta case. Now, in that case, there was a special agreement between Libya and Malta relating to the delimitation of areas of continental shelf appertaining to each of these two states. Now, in support of this argument, Libya relied on the principle of natural prolongation and the concept of proportionality. You know, there are two principles by which there's delimitation of continental shelves: the proportionality and then the equidistance. Now, Malta maintained that states' rights over areas of continental shelf were now governed by the concept of distance from the coast, which was held to confer a primacy on the equidistance method of defining boundaries between areas of continental shelf, particularly when these appertain to states lying directly opposite to each other, as in the Malta and the Libya case. Now, the court found that in view of developments in the law relating to the rights of states over areas of continental shelf, there was no reason to assign a role to geographical or geophysical factors when the distance between the two states was less than 400 miles. It also considered that the equidistance method did not have to be used and was not the only appropriate delimitation technique. The court defined a number of equitable principles and applied them in its judgment of June 3, 1985, in the light of relevant circumstances. It took account of the main features of the coasts, the difference in the length and the distance between them. It took care to avoid any excessive disproportion between the continental shelf appertaining to a state and the length of its coastline, and adopted the solution of a median line transposed northwards over a certain distance. In the course of the proceedings, Italy applied for permission to intervene, claiming that it had an interest of a legal nature under Article 62 of the statute. The court found that the intervention requested by Italy fell, by virtue of its object, into a category which, on Italy's own showing, was one which could not be accepted, and the application was accordingly refused. Now let's go to the, you see, we said customary international law is two-pronged: the material facts and opinio juris. Now let's go to the material facts, which is the practice of states that has become customary law. Now, the actual practice engaged in by state constitutes the initial factor to be considered in finding the existence of international customary law. In determining the practice of state, several factors are taken into account: continuity and repetition. The act in question must be seen to have been done continuously and repeatedly over a period of time. There should not be any inconsistency on the part of states as far as the act is concerned. So in the right to passage over Indian Territory case, where Portugal argued that there existed a right of passage over Indian Territory as between the Portuguese enclaves, the ICJ held that such a right existed under international law between two states because it was shown that over the years there had been continuous and constant practice of allowing free passage. Now, also in the asylum case, the ICJ held that a customary rule must be in accordance with a constant and uniform practice by the state in question. Now, also in the Anglo-Norwegian fisheries case, the ICJ again held that some degree of uniformity and constant practice was essential before a custom could come into existence. Now, number two, generality and uniformity. Another important factor to be considered is how widespread and uniform the act in question is. So it must be noted that most but not all states must be seen to be uniformly observing a particular practice. Now, customary law does not necessarily require all states behaving in a particular pattern, but if majority of states behave in a certain manner consistently, that particular way of life can be deemed as customary international law. Now, see the North Sea continental shelf cases, okay? Then the asylum and Norwegian fisheries cases as well. In the North Sea continental shelf cases, Denmark and Netherlands wanted the court to apply the equidistant principle as a rule of international law in delimiting their coast between them and Germany. Now, due to the absence of the widespread and uniform practice of the said rule by Denmark and Netherlands, the court held that it could not be regarded as a rule of international law to bind Germany. Number three of the material fact, duration. Now, the period of time the practice should have lasted or the practice has lasted is not important. All that is required is the above two, which are the continuity and repetition, and then the generality and uniformity to be proven. Now, even without the passage of any considerable period of time, a very widespread and representative participation in the convention might suffice of itself, provided it includes the states which interests were specifically affected. This was said by the ICJ in the North Sea continental shelf cases. Now, we are saying that customary international law is the practice between states that have become international law. Now, what's the evidence that these practices have gone on? Where do we see them? We can see them in diplomatic correspondence. We can see them in policy statements, in press release, the opinions of legal advisors, official manuals on legal questions, executive decisions and practices, comments by government on drafts produced by the International Law Commission, state legislations, international and national judicial decisions, recitals in treaties and other international instruments, the practice of international organizations, and resolutions of the General Assembly. Now, that has to do with the material facts. Now, let's go to opinio iuris. Now, the subjective belief that a state's activity or practice is legally obligatory is the factor which turns the usage into a custom and renders it part of the rules of international law. So it is a subjective belief of the states that a certain practice has a legal obligation, although that legal obligation is not backed by law. Now, this is evident in Article 38.1c of the ICJ statute, where it stated that general practice accepted as law when indicating customs as a source of international law. Okay, now states must therefore be seen to have expressly or impliedly accepted or consented to a particular practice as a legal obligation which is binding on them to qualify it as a rule of international law. For example, the SS Lotus case. Now, in that case, it was between France and Turkey. A collision occurred shortly before midnight on the 2nd of August 1926 between the French, which are the plaintiffs, and the Turkish, which are the defendants. Now, the French boat was called the SS Lotus, and the Turkish boat, steamboat, was called the Collier Bose Court. Now, the French steamer was captained by a French citizen by name Demons, while the Turkish Collier Bose Court was captained by Hassan Bey. Now, the Turks lost 8 men after their ship cut into 2 and sank as a result of a collision. So, although the Lotus did all in its power to save the situation and help the shipwrecked persons, it continued on its course to Constantinople and arrived there on August 3rd. Now, on the 5th of August, Lieutenant Demons was asked by the Turkish authority to go ashore to give evidence. After Demons was examined, he was placed under arrest without informing the French consul and Hassan Bey. Now, Demons was convicted by the Turkish courts for negligence in allowing the accident to occur. This basis was contended by Demons on the ground that the court lacked jurisdiction over him. With this, both countries agreed to submit to the Permanent Court or Court of International Justice, which was of the League of Nations, the question of whether or not the exercise of Turkish criminal jurisdiction over Demons, who was French, for an incident that occurred on the high seas contravened international law. Now, the issue was, does the rule of international law, which prohibits a state from exercising criminal jurisdiction over a foreign national who commits acts outside of the state's national jurisdiction, exist? Now, it was held that no. A rule of international law which prohibits a state from exercising criminal jurisdiction over a foreign national who commits acts outside of the state's national jurisdiction does not exist. Now, failing the existence of a permissive rule to the contrary is the first and foremost restriction imposed by international law on a state, and may not exercise its power in any form in the territory of another state. This does not imply that international law prohibits a state from exercising jurisdiction in its own territory in respect of any case that relates to acts that have been taking place abroad, which it cannot rely on some permissive rule of international law. Now, in this situation, it is impossible to hold that there's a rule of international law that prohibits Turkey from prosecuting Demons because he was aboard a French ship. This stems from the fact that the effects of the alleged offense occurred on a Turkish vessel. Hence, both states here may exercise concurrent jurisdiction over the matter because there's no rule of international law in regards to collision cases to the effect that criminal proceedings are exclusively within the jurisdiction of the states whose flag is flown. Now, in 1975, the French also enacted a law regarding its criminal jurisdiction over aliens because of this situation around the SS Lotus case. Now, the law stipulates that aliens who commit a crime outside the territory of that republic, France, may be prosecuted and judged pursuant to French law when the victim is of French nationality. So when a French goes to Turkey to commit a crime, it should be prosecuted based on French law and not any other law. Now, in the asylum case, Colombia granted asylum to a Peruvian head of state in Colombia's embassy in Peru. And Colombia wanted a safe passage to transfer the head of state out of Peru, which Peru refused. Colombia was trying to rely on a practice that was developing among the South Americans, that a state granting asylum has the right to determine whether the perpetrator's offense is of a political nature or not. If it is of a political nature, then a state granting the asylum has the right to decide whether to hand over the offender to the state after him or not. Colombia sued Peru and tried to rely on this new practice as a reason for Peru to allow for a free passage for Jair de la Torre, who was the offender. Now, its claim failed partly due to the fact that it failed to prove that Peru had accepted the practice as a rule of international law, which was opinio iuris. Okay, so did Peru have opinio iuris on that particular rule? For a new customary law to be formed, not only must the act concerned amount to a settled practice, but it must be accompanied by opinio iuris sive necessitas, which is what we are calling opinio iuris. It was stated in the North Sea Continental Shelf cases and also in the Nicaragua case. Now, let's go to certain principles in the formation of customary international law. Now, since let's deal with a persistent objector, okay, to the formation of a public international law or customary international law. Since consent is an important principle under international law, states must be seen to have consented to a custom as a legal obligation before they are bound by it. right? Now, any state who does not want to be bound by a particular custom must object to its formation from the onset. From the onset, such objection must be expressed. Any state which is able to prove clearly that it objected to the formation of a particular custom will not be bound by it. For example, is the asylum case where Peru showed that it did not consent to the practice that a state who is giving asylum to somebody must determine whether or not the person is a political is seeking political asylum, and then if he's seeking political asylum, must determine whether or not the offender must be taken away or must be prosecuted in his own country. Now, the restatement of the foreign relations law of the U.S. reads that in principle, a state that indicates its dissent from a practice while the law is still in the process of development is not bound by that rule, even if it matures. A state that protests the legitimizing of a particular practice as a rule of international law will not be. Norwegian fisheries case. This was a basis for the court's decision in the asylum case when the ICJ rejected. In the asylum case, the ICJ rejected Colombia's argument that a local custom was developing among South Americans when a state granting asylum has the right to determine whether the offense of the offender is a political crime or not. It was proved clearly that Peru objected expressly to the formation of this practice and hence could not be bound by it. This rule, however, is subject to rules that have attained the status of ius cogens. Or jus cogens. Okay, so jus cogens are general principles from which there can be no derogation, right? So that means that the thing has been, jus cogens is a principle of law that has been generally accepted so much, it has gained a universal scope so much that nobody can derogate from it. Nobody can take anything away from it. Nobody can say that he's not bound by it. So once a particular rule attains the status of jus cogens, every state would be bound by it. So it is immaterial whether a state objected to its formation. So the persistent objector can object to the formation of a particular principle. But if he acquiesces his rights to that objection, and then the principle becomes jus cogens, he cannot derogate from that principle. Now, let's also go to the principle of acquiescence. Now, acquiescence may be defined as the equivalent of a tacit recognition manifested by a unilateral conduct, which the other party may interpret as consent and as founded upon the principles of good faith and equity. This was said in the Gulf of Maine case by the ICJ. Now, what this ostensibly means is that if you see somebody doing something and then you watch as the person goes on to do the thing to his detriment, knowing that you have the right to stop that person, you cannot thereafter go on to object to it after the person has finished that project or whatever it is to his detriment. The court will not allow you. That means that you are passively acquiesced. Okay, now generally, where states are seen to acquiesce in the behavior of a practice of other states without protesting against them, the assumption must be that such behavior is accepted as legitimate. Now, acquiescence can amount to consent to formation of customary rule, and the absence of protest may imply agreement. Now, where a state or states take action which they declare to be legal, the silence of others can be used as an expression of opinio iuris or a concurrence in the legal rule. Therefore, this means actual protest is called for to break the legitimizing process. Now, in the South China Sea arbitration case, where China sought to claim ownership over some portion of the South China Sea, on the principle of historical right, the arbitration held that for this principle to operate, state must be seen to have consented and acquiesced to such a title to China. However, it was clear that Palestine and the Philippines and other states objected to China's exercise of title over the sea, and hence that objection broke the legitimizing process that would have bound the other states if they had acquiesced their rights. Also, in the Anglo-Norwegian fisheries case, Norway used the straight baseline method to delimit its coast due to the coast indented nature and cost to be included in its territorial waters, what would have been part of the high seas. Now, England challenged this method, but the ICJ held that since this delimitation system had been used continuously by states, unchallenged, and due to the lack of objections from states, including the English, it meant that there was concurrence and there was an emergence of a legal rule, and hence Norway. Now, so evidence of opinio iuris of states can be deduced from what has already been stated before as material fact. We can also use, when we talked about diplomatic correspondence and all those things, those are evidences of state opinio iuris. Okay, all right. So this sums up customary international law as a source of public international law. We will go on and treat other sources of law in the next podcast. Thank you very much.